Nassau Athletic Association and your local National Weather Service office.
Today, all Americans are feeling the pinch of high energy prices. And this winter, the cost of heating your home could account for nearly half of your energy bill. I'm Energy Secretary Sam Bodman, with steps you can take to save money and make your home more energy efficient. First, give your home furnace or heat pump a checkup to ensure it's running as efficiently as possible. Proper insulation in attic, ceilings, floors, crawl spaces, and exterior and basement walls can save 30% on your home energy bill. And insulate the heating ducts, even in unheated areas of your house. Finally, installing a programmable thermostat will ensure you don't pay for energy you aren't using. Program the thermostat down to 65 degrees for 8 hours a day to reduce your heating bill by up to 10%. You have the power to make a difference. You can reduce your home energy bills and help our nation reduce its energy use.
For more energy efficiency tips, please visit our website at www.doe.gov or call toll-free 1-877-337-3463. This powerful savings message is provided by the U.S. Department of Energy and the Alliance to Save Energy.
And you're listening to radio station WUSB, Stony Brook. It's 6 o'clock time once again for Off the Wall. Well, it's another Tuesday evening, and that means it's time for Off the Wall. If it's 6 p.m., at least, that means it's time for Off the Wall. And then you'll hear Kyle over there.
Yes, it's another scorcher here in the WUSB studios. That's right. We have the heat turned up to 85 degrees.
Why do people do that?
Because, you know, what's the point in having working equipment? Let's just fry everything, overheat everything.
The difference between this studio and the previous one, we can control it now.
But
it seems like even though we can control it, we still want to overheat ourselves. This is a parallel to what's going on in the country, I think. Even though we have the power to make things better, we choose the path that hurts us. But you're fixing it?
I've already adjusted it to just below 70 Fahrenheit.
Okay.
Which I think is appropriate because it's like it's still warm enough, you know, you can put a sweater on, but it's not like over 70, like you're actively heating equipment.
I can't do this.
What?
Why?
Fahrenheit?
Why?
Celsius?
I don't understand. When I was a kid, we learned Celsius. When did we give this up? You're speaking Fahrenheit now. I'm looking at it. Look, there's a digital thermometer here.
Oh, that got changed.
It's Fahrenheit. I want to change this to Celsius. I'm going to do it right now on the air because I'm fed up with this.
Did we do
it? Why? Why have we given up on Celsius and joining the rest of the world? This is a microcosm. Okay, we fix this. Maybe other things will follow. But for God's sake, people, why do we use this system? How do you change this damn clock?
I don't know. Are there instructions that are, like, pasted on the back? You probably have to go through a bunch of menus and...
59 degrees F. No, I don't. That's like 11 or 12. I don't know. Point is, it's a system that the rest of the world uses, except for maybe like the Seychelles Islands or something. I think there's one Central American country that for some reason is using Fahrenheit. But come on, the rest of the world. I'm sorry, I totally stepped on your explanation of our other problem, which is our temperature in here.
Yeah, I know. I mean, well, it's... I guess beside the point, the units of measurement, it's still heat, and suffice to say, we've remedied that, and it is warming up. It's not quite, it's rainy,
but
a lot of the springtime plants are emerging. People are getting exercise because it's nice outside. They're active. There's a lot of baseball and springtime sports here on campus, and joy is in the air.
Yeah, the other day, the Mets won 9-0. It might have been a couple of weeks ago, but I pointed that out to you. We were in a bar, because we spent a lot of time in bars. And I pointed out, remember this moment, Kyle, because it's never going to happen again. The Mets won 9-0. These things matter.
9-0. That's like a parallel, strange universe. I can't even...
Wow.
Our Mets? The Mets?
The same.
What does Mets even stand for?
Metropolitans.
The Metropolitans.
Uh-huh. I don't know if that was their original name, but that's supposed to be what it stands for.
Highfalutin.
You know what the Yankees were called?
Yanks?
Okay, that's really clever and true, but it's not correct, at least not what I'm thinking. And there's actually two answers to this question, people. Two answers. I'll accept either one, Kyle.
Yankee Doodle, Yankee...
This is the sound of Kyle thinking.
Original
name of the New York Yankees.
New Amsterdamers.
That's good. That's clever. But no.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
All right. I tried. Go ahead.
Did you really try?
As far as you're concerned. Go ahead. Tell me.
They were the New York Highlanders.
But
before they were the New York Highlanders, you know what else they were? They were the Baltimore Orioles. Yeah, it's true. Look it up. Don't believe me. Nobody ever does. All right, so with that bit of trivia, here's a bit of fact. Today is Giving Tuesday, which means give. Give to us. And we're supposed to give, too. Everybody give. Give to WUSB, because it's the last day of our fundraiser, and apparently the whole campus is involved, because everyone's talking about Giving Tuesday. Although I think other people have their hands out as well. But regardless, we have the cleanest hands out. So please, whatever you can pledge to us.
And meager goals. Your pledge will surprise, stun, shock, astound us.
Yes.
Your contributions to this fine community radio station and bastion of communications education and free speech and wonderful cultural and musical programming.
That's correct. You can pledge by going to WUSB.FM, follow all the information there on the website, and you'll get really cool things.
Yeah, if you give, you get.
You get. Yeah, it's true. You do get.
Yeah.
You get us, for one thing. I mean, you don't get us because nobody gets us. But
no, but it's the main thing.
You receive us. You receive us on your radio dial.
You get our transmissions.
Yeah. And or online, you know, you can look at our podcast or whatever.
But you get physical stuff as a big thank you. Big thank you.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you right now, the new WUSB sweatshirt, it's pretty cool. Bright green. I think you can get in other colors, too.
I haven't seen that.
Oh, it's nice. There's actually pictures up. Well, I don't know if you can see it. You're at the console there, but
I'm starboard.
Yeah, exactly. It's on the other side of the ship here. There are mugs and tote bags and mixed CDs of various types, various combinations at pledge levels that match our frequency, like the 90.1 club. That's for $90.10.
And the 107.3 club.
Yes, that is our translator frequency.
Uh-huh. And I had the idea to add the two together, but that idea has not been responded to.
Right. But as I began with, our goals for this day of giving are meager. It's not that much. We're very close to it. So if you have the time, please, please, please get online, WUSB.FM, or call in. And pledge your support. And operators, somebody will stand by. We're here, and we'll sort it out. But the long and the short of it is we really, really value your contributions. And for that, we will contribute interesting conversation like this show.
Well, yeah, hopefully. We try to be interesting, but sometimes we do. I'll leave it at that. Things are going on. Joe Biden is leading the race on the Democratic side. What do you think about that?
What do I think about that? Way to put me on the spot.
he dives in weeks after everybody else. He's number 20, literally number 20, and skyrockets to number one. And name recognition, I guess, you know, former vice president, former senator, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, excuse me. Of Obama fame?
Oh, yeah, Obama fame.
That Joe Biden?
The same.
Our Joe Biden?
I don't know if he's our Joe Biden, but he's a Joe Biden.
Yes, we Joe.
Uh-huh. All right, well, you take your cup of Joe somewhere else then. I just want to know, you know, how it jives with you. I mean, is it something that we're good with? Is it part of the whole dialogue thing? Are we going to be stronger for this? Is it just a moment of despair?
Personally, I mean, I don't really know what is best for everyone else or for the country or for the Democratic Party or for, you know, people I don't agree with or people I do agree with or even my own family. But I personally am ready for – I'm open to anything. I don't really think it needs to be Joe. If Joe is going to win, then I'm you know, potentially – behind him, but I'm ready for anything new. I mean, really, I like the energy. I like the differences and distinctions of different candidates that are coming forward. But I don't know that it needs to be any one person. I'd like a change. I'd like something other than what we currently have. And the real things that matter to me are like the infrastructure, and some of that stuff was in the news today, but I want better leadership. I'm really tired of the trash heap of political drama, and I think of a lot of other voters are. I want something that's good, steady leadership that I can be proud of, even if I disagree. I want some more presidentialness, because I feel like we've been devoid of that for several of the past years. Maybe not all of them, okay, if, you know, I need to give credit at all, but...
No, wait, if you're going to say give credit, then give credit. What credit? I'm going to call you on that. What credit can you possibly give over the last couple of years?
Yeah.
you know, okay, I'll give credit. Defiance. Defiance is cool. when you have something to be defiant about. But this is defiance for the sake of defiance.
Yeah, I mean, stupid swagger is not an important category, is it?
No.
Okay, so we've had a lot of stupid swagger, which is nice, but it's stupid.
Yeah, you know, in contrast to all the negative things that have happened, developments that have happened, doesn't really stand out to me.
Do you remember when we were talking about unifying at the beginning of this current term? Like, let's unify, the inauguration will be this opportunity to bring people together after such a heated political divide.
Well, when you say we, do you mean we? Do you mean the nation, the mainstream media?
And
by bring together, do you mean everybody on all sides? Do you mean the opposition?
I think as Americans, you know, we have yet to come around to any kind of unity. And if anything, we're more, I think, divided and less keen on one another than we started.
Well, that's definitely true. I mean, we are as divided, I think, as we've ever been without actually coming to blows. And in some cases, we are coming to blows. It's concerning to see where this is going to go. Having the dialogue, I think, is the most important thing. If we shy away from the dialogue, then all we're left with are just the opposing sides without even knowing what we stand for.
But I would just add, I would love to see a female president. I think that's due. I think it was due during the last presidential cycle, and we did not get that. And I would like to see a lot younger leadership. And I think it's there. I think there's a really good pool of people younger than I am. I can't believe I'm saying
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I know.
That's growing up for you. But that really could take hold. And you know, maybe not entirely unify, but, you know, that obviously didn't matter in this cycle. But really take this country where it needs to go.
I've had one president younger than me so far, and I might get another one in 2020. So, yeah, there's a moment where you know, the president is younger than you. That's a moment in your life that you should always remember.
I think Joe specifically, if he does not really tap and get youth around him, I'm talking in his cabinet, if he does become a president of sorts, but I mean in his campaign, I think if you're going to go old like Bernie or whomever else to kind of match up with the current president, I would definitely want to know that the people around you are keeping it real and are bringing youthful vigor, because I think it's too easy for them, for older candidates to come off as way out of touch.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's inspirational, I suppose, you know, and if I'm going to give Trump credit for anything, it's wow, okay, he's 72 and you know, he's still able to be a monumental jerk and cause all these problems and somehow have the energy to keep doing it without stopping. And that, you know, that's inspirational.
Yeah, so are Twinkies that are 70.
You know,
they're still technically edible.
Uh-huh.
Got it.
Yeah.
That's so inspiring.
Okay, well, you understand. That's sometimes you just have to marvel at these things. How is that possible?
I think that's basically a direct parallel.
But our current president is 72. Okay, if Joe Biden were to be elected in 2020, he'd be 77 when he got elected.
Uh-huh.
Bernie would be 78. You know, that's what we're dealing with right now. Not necessarily a bad thing. It's good to have all these senior citizens that are active. For some reason, presidents live a very long time into their 90s. Must be the health care. But there are, as you say, a lot of younger candidates out there. And if they are not involved, they are not a part of this dialogue, and they don't have a good chance. First of all, the fact that Joe Biden is ahead now means very little. In fact, I think in most cases, the vast majority of the cases, the person who was ahead early on does not make it in the end.
Right. It doesn't foretell what will actually what it will boil down to, right?
So, yeah, if anything, it's a curse.
Yeah.
So the fact that he's ahead now, let's not make that mean more than it does. What I don't want to see, though, are people giving up saying, oh, it's just, you know, the status quo, the same old people are going to be in. No, it's not true. It's not true if we don't make that true. We have to have the dialogue. We have to change positions, move the party in a particular direction so that we're not just having the same conversations we had 10, 20 years ago. And I think we're set up to do that. I think it's very promising. And I think even Biden would agree with that. And what we get in the end, hopefully, is something everybody can stand behind, because it would be the most monumental of all stupid moves to be divided after the convention next year, running up to the election, because that is exactly what will get Trump a second term. We have to believe. And right now, you know, is there anybody in the field of 20 that that you would not be okay with being president at this point? I mean, I can say, well, there are a couple people I don't think I know. Those names I literally don't know. But everything I've seen so far, I can live with that. But I should also point out, I don't know anybody that I see in my daily life that I would not be okay with them being president as well. Because
under the circumstances.
Yeah, that's how I feel. Anybody pretty much. Yeah, hey, you're busy for the next 4 years? Please, please, help save us. But I'm not diametrically opposed to anybody, like strongly opposed. There are people I feel strongly about that I think would be really, really good, and I'll be disappointed if they don't move forward. But I kind of expect my taste not to catch on, because that's pretty much been the story of my life. You know, right or wrong, I usually don't get what I want, and I think a lot of people don't get what they want. And how you deal with that kind of defines what you get.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't say I'm against anyone in particular myself, but I have, I don't know. I'm not as inspired by everyone in the pool of candidates.
Mm-hmm.
I think Corey is bland.
Yeah, you know, he's not
too
as
folksy and nice.
I expected more from him. I really did. I expected him to be a lot more. What's the word? Filled with vigor and combative and just. And Elizabeth Warren, you know, I wanted her to run 4 years ago, 3 years ago. And now that she's running, I mean, she's saying great things, but for some reason, she's a distant third right now. Hopefully that will change, because I still think she has an awful lot to say. I love Bernie's message, but. He needs that younger. He has a younger demographic, obviously, but he needs younger representation as well. And you know, pairing with somebody decades younger, I think, will definitely help him. I think, you know, some of these people get together and don't destroy each other in debates or campaigns, they could be a really strong ticket.
Alliance wise, you mean?
Uh huh.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Joining forces, being open to that. I hope that is a part of the way this campaign cycle, this primary cycle, plays out. That there is magnanimous. I don't know what the word is, but relatively a willingness to get along and to forge relationships and stuff that will. Endure and, you know, become strong teams if this goes the Democrats' way, right? I mean,
yeah, right now you'd say let's pair up Biden and Sanders, you know, a Bernie Biden ticket. Yeah, it sounds good on paper because they're both, you know, number one and number two.
What about Biden Buttigieg?
Well, I'll get to that, but the reason why I don't think. This would be a good idea. You'd have the two people who are in their upper 70s.
Exactly.
What message does that send? You need somebody younger. Yeah, who in Buttigieg?
Biden Buttigieg.
I prefer Bernie Buttigieg. I still can't say it, even though I know how to say it. But we'll get over that.
Warren
know?
Buttigieg.
We can
Harris
change.
Buttigieg.
As a country, we can change. We can learn how to pronounce names that are different. And I think that's kind of a microcosm of what we have to do.
Or Harris Warren.
Well, two females.
Why not?
Okay, all right. Kind of suspicious of Harris, only because of the way she acted in the town hall. She kept saying, yeah, I want to have a conversation about that, not really addressing issues and just being a little bit too much of a politician.
Yeah, she was a little cagey. I think I think I would put Corey in that category, too, because blandness, not strident enough. When he is angry about something, it's really kind of doesn't have much filling, or it's all filler. You know, it's not enough substance to it.
And unfortunately, those are the two African-American candidates, you know? So, that's a sock in the face. You know, I don't know. We need to have this conversation. We need to have debates, and we need to be engaged.
I want to see more platforms, too, because I, as I'm talking here, I'm realizing this is all basically from, like, sound bites, maybe a couple interviews on some shows, mm-hmm. and like, you mentioned the town hall and stuff like that, but, like, let's see some real platforms come out and actually, like, weigh, like, okay, this is what this candidate is going to put their name behind. This is what they're going to have as the foundation of how they move forward. I know Sanders probably has that ready to go as far as the platform, and he's been talking about it for almost a decade, and maybe Warren, too, as far as a concrete platform. But it would be nice to get a grid or do like a side-by-side comparison of all of the platforms they've put forth and try to correlate what they mean, if, you know, put like platforms and what candidates have said together, so you can really get a sense of what substance there is, whether the candidate of concern has referenced it and talked about it or not. And then, you know, compare that to the incumbent's platform or lack thereof.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be interesting. It'd be, I think, a little bit more analytical way to get a perspective. Because right now we're really just getting, like, you know, press releases, announcements, you know, little social media things and fits and spurts that are, you know, the kickoffs and whatnot. Maybe, like, the rallies that look like rallies, but they're not quite a huge rally. That kind of stuff is not a lot to go on as you're, you know, diving into it. But it's going to be a healthy bit of discussion and policy issues over the summer, right? I mean,
the other thing what we need to be wary of are the issues that the right wing will focus upon and use them to trip up the candidates, such as the voting from prison thing. When was this ever a campaign item, giving people who are currently in prison the ability to vote? I don't know if we've ever done that.
That's a misnomer.
If it's been done, I don't know where it's been done.
No, it was about re-establishing rights for ex-felons.
Right, not to take away rights from people who have already served their time.
But it's become this, like, creep of conversation from actual legislation to potential legislation, and then we can paint somebody and characterize them as the felon, you know.
It always turns into the worst possible person. For instance, when they had the town halls last week, would you allow the Boston Marathon bomber to vote from prison? Because, you know, that's the worst possible person, and we happen to be in New England. And of course, you know, emotionally, it sounds like a horrible thing when you say, yes, that person should be allowed to vote. There are countries, I think Norway is one of them, where people in prison do vote. It's no big deal. You have to ask yourself, what are you afraid of? In this country, I'm not aware of it happening. If it has been happening, then I'm ignorant of that. But to make that the issue that trips people up, I think is a bad idea. And it's, of course, what Fox News is going to jump upon to try and make somebody seem like they're soft on crime or something like that.
Oh, and
don't take the bait.
And there's so much hyperbole you can add around conversations of felons. These are the worst. You can hear it already, right?
Yeah, well, most people in prison and most felons are not violent.
Well, yeah, and I would just add in this conversation that what that hijacks or short circuits is any discussion of prisoners' rights, of the conditions that felons are subject to in private prisons. And, you know, there's a lot of issues just with incarceration as a topic in this country that kind of get overlooked in if that becomes the only way we can talk about felons and, you know, this particular aspect of it, which is non-question of, like, should felons be able to vote? Well, it's not really a precedent that anybody's questioning right now. And the only legislation we've really seen of late is allowing those individuals who have served their time to reestablish their right to vote. And I think that is actually less related to prisoners and more an aspect of disenfranchisement and voting in general, more so than it is a topic about prisoners. You want to talk about prison, you want to talk about incarceration, there's a lot there, especially, you know, for a candidate, if that's mm-hmm. where we're going to go with it. But to just use it as hyperbole
exactly,
as a gotcha, I think is insane.
Let's talk about why there are so many people in prison in the first place, more so than any other country. And it's disgusting, and it's indicative of a failure that we have, and we have to have that conversation. There's also, you know, there are things going on right now today. We've been watching the news about Venezuela, about all the craziness going on in the streets there. And honestly, I hope Maduro gets toppled. I think he's a vile person, and I think the regime there is terrible. But that said, if the United States muscles its way into that situation, then that would be a very bad negative thing. And I'm watching the situation with trepidation, because you have idiots like John Bolton speaking out, telling the world what's what, and being taken seriously. That is just as disturbing as you can imagine. For him to go on today and say that, Cuba, you got to get out of that country. You have to stop trying to influence things. You know, meanwhile, we've got a torture chamber on Cuban land. So sit your ass down, John Bolton. You've got no standing here to talk about human rights, about what countries should do and should not do. It's disgusting. So, yeah, by all means, I hope the people of Venezuela get rid of this guy and install something a bit fairer that will get their prosperity back and keep us the hell away, because we have no business there. Absolutely not. Russia doesn't either. But that's not a ticket for us to go plowing in. And, you know, the likes of Trump and Bolton and all the other thugs and idiots that are running things now would be the worst possible scenario.
Yeah, it would set them up for exploitation and extraction of wealth and resources, which is our playbook in all of these kinds of places. That's how we roll. Uh-huh. We put our boot in the door and let in the corporations that would like to extract that wealth. And then we wrap it up when they're done.
Pick any country in South America or Central America, and you will see our history there. And it is not for the people. So do not trust this regime. I cannot stress that enough. And I certainly hope the people there are able to band together, get the military on their side, because that is essential for anything to happen. But it's a fight they have to fight, and it's going to be something. It really will be.
Yeah, interesting, and developments sure to come, and we'll definitely keep watching that situation.
So New York Democrats today took their first step towards releasing Donald Trump's state tax returns to Congress.
Woohoo!
Yeah, because he has to file state tax returns as well as federal tax returns. We've been talking about this for a while. A key state Senate committee advanced a bill that would authorize the state tax department to release New York tax returns to a congressional committee upon request. Of course, that's despite spirited objections by Republicans. Now, the difference now is the Democrats are running the show in New York. Yeah, the Democratic-led Senate plans to approve the measure next week. It would then be up to the overwhelmingly Democratic Assembly to follow suit, although Speaker Carl Heste of the Bronx, Democrat, indicated the bill isn't on the chamber's near-term schedule at the moment. Well, let's change that. Democrats said the bill was about oversight, accountability, and Trump's unwillingness to make his returns public, which ended a long-running tradition by presidential candidates. A state tax return could reveal much of the same information as a federal one. If the federal government isn't prepared to deliver the transparency and accountability the American people deserve, New York will. That's according to Senator Brian Benjamin, Democrat of Manhattan, chairman of the Senate Budget and Revenue Committee. this is what we need to do. This is absolutely what has to happen. Senator Brad Hoyleman, also a Democrat of Manhattan, the bill's sponsor, said the intent wasn't to publicly release Trump's tax returns, but more broadly to make sure any congressional oversight committee can receive any New York tax returns it seeks. And I'm good with that. He noted the U.S. House requested the president's returns earlier this month, but neither the IRS nor the White House have complied. And they're getting away with that somehow. New York State does this all the time in terms of sharing tax returns, state returns with other states, with the IRS, with other federal departments. But Republicans are having none of it. If Congress can't go to the IRS to get the president's tax returns, why are we interfering, says Senator Robert Antonacci, Republican of Syracuse. Well, Robert, if Congress can't go, Congress did go to the IRS. The IRS is not following the law. They're in Trump's pocket right now. So don't put that on Congress. Put that on the IRS. If the IRS refuses to cooperate, we'll go around them. That's what's important. Jumping in, Senator James Tedisco, Republican of Schenectady, called the end run sad and suggested it could help Trump win re-election. This is a sad attempt to delegitimize an election and a president, he said. What's the next step? Because this isn't going to end. After you get his taxes, are you going to want to get the number of suits and where he buys them and how much it costs? Maybe this is a gift to the people of America because you're going to solidify his next election next year. Well, I'll tell you what, James, if that's true, why are you opposing it? If this is going to solidify his election and you're a Republican that supports Trump, you should be encouraging this. So, all right, fine. We'll take the bait, solidify his election. Let's see the returns. Let's see it. And as far as how many suits he has, well, if he stole the suits, yeah, I'd like to know. If they're made off the back of slave children in some third world country, yeah, I'd like to know how many of those he has. He's our president, for God's sake. We need to know these things. Why is this being hidden from us? Just last night, we learned that Trump is suing banks to keep Democrats from investigating his finances. He's suing Deutsche Bank as well as Capital One in an attempt to block the banks from responding to subpoenas from two House panels seeking personal financial documents. It's basically you have robber barons in charge now.
Criminal.
Thinking they can just flout the law, disobey subpoenas, disobey investigations, and just get their way and hide all the information. Why would anybody support that? Why are people saying, yeah, we don't need to know this? Yeah, you do. Regardless of whose side you're on, you need to know the facts. And, this document, the series of documents, absolutely will tell you something. And then you can make a decision.
Yeah, I think they're showing their hand by having to sue those entities. If they were in good standing or if there would be a guarantee of business in the future, or if they cared at all about those business relationships, I guess is what I'm saying, they might be willing to protect whatever privacy or secrecy he thinks he's entitled to. But by suing them, you're kind of – that is an antagonistic behavior. And suing them to not comply with government requests.
Yeah, that's insane.
Is like so outside the scope of what any private entity would want to get into, I think, even within our, especially within our borders, to be asking those firms to do that, especially with Deutsche Bank's record. I don't know. Not really a good look. I don't know how much more like casino business y'all are trying to loan out to President Dude, but I would be cautious as a firm.
I'm trying to put myself in this position. If I was a Trump person, all right, and okay, I need to take something to get there, but I can try. I have a good imagination. If I was a Trump supporter, I would say, dude, what are you doing? This makes you look bad, really bad. Show these idiots that you've got nothing to hide, that everything you do is on the up and up, and you have an answer for everything. You're a smart guy. Come on, you can stand up to these bullies. Show them, and your support will skyrocket, because when you show them that you're an honest business person, okay, I can't do it anymore. I just can't add honest business person to pretending to support Trump.
Think about how
it doesn't compute.
Think about how badly cooked his books have to be for him to not want anybody to look at the cooked version of things. Like, I mean, wow. You know, you'd think if he figured it all out, he's a great business guy, like, this all this stuff would be done, dusted, squeaky, Windex, sprayed, covered, and protected, all that. But nah.
You know, but now, you know, the doors are starting to close in. The walls are closing in. Everything's closing in. You've got two banks now. You've got Capital One. You've got Deutsche Bank. And the records are in their possession. They have lots of employees, lots of potential leakers. I'm not saying that's the road that will be traveled down. But the potential certainly does exist. By the way, did I mention that we run a SecureDrop installation? 2600.com/SecureDrop. All the instructions are there. Now, we have the state tax people. We've got the IRS, which right now is in Trump's pocket and is not cooperating with the law. And we have these two banks and who knows how many other people. At some point, something is going to give. And information will get out. You can't keep this secret forever. And my only concern is that it not be kept secret for another year or two. Because people need to know the facts. They need to know what's going on. They need to know the truth. And if you're arguing against that, ask yourself why you're arguing against these facts.
And would you put up with it were this not your team? If like the other previous administration or a Hillary administration, God help us, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If they were doing this kind of stuff after having had an investigation.
I would not be defending Hillary if she was acting like this. Absolutely
after
not.
After her special counsel investigation and then after her fighting the banks and the IRS. Yeah, I think at a certain point the allegiance would fade.
I would not be defending Obama if he acted like that. I would not be defending anybody. You, Kyle, if you started acting like this, I wouldn't defend you.
How do you know I haven't already? Okay, no, I believe you.
I try to talk to you first, but if you continue to be pig-headed like this, I'd say, Kyle, this is bad, and you should do the right thing.
You've forgotten yourself.
Yeah.
Come to your senses, man.
Uh-huh. Stuff like that. So, yeah, those people out there that support this guy, maybe you want to encourage him to do the right thing so that we can move ahead and you know, have honest conversations rather than suspicion.
Maybe he should do it. Maybe we should sit down and have the president go through his finances and explain exactly why things appear the way they do. It'd be like a truth and reconciliation thing, you know? Like, yeah, you know what? All right, you got me. But if I'm about to be found out here, let me go ahead and I'll go through, I'll explain why, and we can look at it together as a nation.
Yeah, and if you're just being obstinate for the sake of being obstinate, really? I mean, you're the president of the United States. Let's move past this, because this obstinance is what's keeping us here for a lot longer than we need to be here. This should have been dealt with during the campaign, like everybody else who complied and showed their financial records. And you being a billionaire, you being a financial person, it's all the more relevant to who you actually are. And to you know, to hold back on that is, you know, even if you are completely honest, it makes you look really dishonest. Why would you want to do that? Why would you want to look that way in front of the entire world? Why would you want to destroy the reputation of this country and the office
and your base?
Yeah, and just make it so divisive if you have nothing to hide. So. I hope this gets resolved. I hope this gets resolved soon because it's really coming to a fever pitch. And I hope the Democrats continue. I hope they don't back down or get intimidated by anything. Impeachment, you know, people are talking about impeachment. I still think that's the way to go. I think there's enough evidence here. But I do understand the arguments against it, the political arguments against it. I don't think they're, you know, they have much morality behind them because it seems like you're thinking more about reelection than about what's right. But at the same time, you don't get reelected. You can't do what's right. I get it. I don't like it, but I'll respect it if that is what they decide. And, you know, I just hope that we see a reckoning for all the things that have been done so badly. I really hope that it does not, you know, result in a free pass. So much bad stuff going on in the world. We read about it every day. There was a shooting at a synagogue last week. And, of course, the horrors in Sri Lanka and in New Zealand and all the plots that almost came about. Such hatred in the air, such horror, really, towards other religions, other people. And it's fostered by ultranationalism. It's fostered by demonizing people who are different, and by believing that you're under some kind of attack, that people are posing a threat to you. It makes people really nervous, defensive, and ultimately violent. And it's something that we really need to address and fix. And obviously, at the upper levels of our government right now, that's not happening. That's not happening. You have all kinds of bad statements. I'm not going to say misstatements, because it's what they mean to say. It's just showing all kinds of just really negative views and ignorant views that we need to challenge. And we are challenging. We are challenging them on every level.
I would say malformed views.
Malformed conclusions. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This is nothing new. This kind of thing has been going on for a long, long time. I hope that we would be further along than we are now, but maybe in order to move ahead, we need to take a step behind so that we have more momentum when we move ahead. I don't know. We've been watching our Academy Award-winning films, and we saw one the other night that actually addressed this very issue. It's called Gentleman's Agreement. It was the Oscar winner in 1947 with Gregory Peck, and it's about anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism was a real issue in the late 40s because, well, people started to find out what actually happened in World War II. They started to learn about the Holocaust, and they started to realize, hey, this kind of hatred, this kind of fear, it's here as well. It's not just in Germany. It's not just in Europe. It's right here in the good old USA. And I was surprised. You know, I saw this film, and I saw dialogue that I wasn't expecting to see in a 1947 film. It's something that I don't think many people even are aware of, because I've never heard of this film before. I've heard, you know, It's a Wonderful Life and all that kind of thing. But this film, no, never heard of it. And I was surprised that it was being dealt with so directly. And the funny thing is that there was pressure not to make this film. This is what's cool about it. Pressure not to make the film by Hollywood executives who were afraid that by making this film, it would stir things up and make things more unpleasant. Not only was the film made, but that very scene was incorporated into the film so that the character who was the newspaper reporter who was going to do a story on anti-Semitism was being encouraged by a group of people not to do this because it would stir things up. That is how you address ignorance, by making it louder and showing why it's wrong. I thought that was a really good good reaction.
And it made it, I think, it makes it real, right? It gives it, lends more, even more authenticity, because it's something that the people producing it went through in realizing the film itself, which is, I think, brilliant. But, yeah the directness as well, it's amazing how the storyline is and how it approaches it and how it is a constant discussion. And it's really interesting also that they're confronted by a child in the family, in the protagonist's family, and have to explain in awkward terms what's going on.
What is anti-Semitism?
What is religion? Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a great tool. How do you describe these kinds of things? And I think approaching it like you would explain to a young person what something is, you have to break it down and try to make distinctions. It was very cool.
To a kid, it's, you know, this kind of thing doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense until the adults get involved and pollute their minds. The story here, I'm going to play an excerpt, actually. The story here is that a reporter for this quote-unquote liberal magazine, it based in New York City, played by Gregory Peck. He has a son. They've just moved to New York City with his mother as well, Gregory Peck's mother, that is. His assignment is to write about anti-Semitism. His idea in order to write about anti-Semitism is to pretend to be Jewish. And by doing that, he witnesses anti-Semitism directly, very quickly, too. His son has no issue with that because to his son, everybody is pretty much the same. However, it catches up to him when some neighborhood kids start calling him names and beating him up because they hear he's Jewish. So the kid has just come home and, relayed all this horrible information. And Gregory Peck has a love interest, played by Dorothy McGuire. Her first reaction when the kid comes in and says that these neighborhood kids beat him up because they said he was Jewish, her first reaction is to say, but they're wrong. You're not. You know, instead of saying that the racism, the anti-Semitism is wrong, she's basically reaffirming that he doesn't have to worry because he's not Jewish. Wrong answer. Here's a conversation that took place immediately after that.
Bill, I've got something to tell you. I'm pretty tired of feeling wrong. Everything I do or say is wrong about anything Jewish. All I did just now was to face facts about Dave and Darian and to tell Tom just what you told him.
Just what? You've only assured him that he's the most wonderful of all creatures, a white Christian American. You instantly gave him a lovely taste of superiority, the poison that millions of parents dropped on the minds of millions of children.
You really do think I'm an anti-Semite?
No, I don't.
You do. You've thought it secretly for a long time.
No, it's just that I've come to see that lots of nice people who aren't, people who despise it and detest it and deplore it and protest their own innocence, help it along and I wonder why it grows. People who never beat up a Jew or your kike at a child. People who think that anti-Semitism is something away off in some dark crackpot place with low-class morons. That's the biggest discovery I've made about this whole business, Kathy. The good people. The nice people.
And that's so true. The good people. The nice people. The ones that aren't the problem. They're the ones that remain quiet. Don't say anything. That speaks to today so much. You know, and I never expected a film from the 40s to be so relevant today, but it really is.
Yeah, reinforcing the dominance and superiority and stuff. I think that is very eloquently written into what this journalist is finding in writing his article and really becoming a method investigative reporter by taking this on and really delving into what it means, this identity and then how people are treated when they identify that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I mentioned, we're seeing all the Academy Award-winning films year by year, and this wasn't the first one to tackle some rather relevant issues. The year before that, the 19th Academy Awards for 1946, saw a film called The Best Years of Our Lives, which is about returning troops from World War II and the challenges they have to face. Focuses on three soldiers who have to reacclimate to life in the United States, trying to find jobs, trying to just get back on their feet again, reestablish relationships.
Deal with losing limbs and the difficulties of adjusting. Physically.
Yeah. There's a guy, Howard Russell. He was a World War II veteran. He lost both his hands in the war, and he was the star of this movie. He'd never acted before, really drove home a message in a way that had not been seen before. This was true history from, a world that had just lived through a very traumatic series of events. And, again, I'd never heard of this film either. The Best Years of Our Lives. Never heard of this film, and it was really captivating and educational.
Yeah, really. And I think historically accurate. There's so much that had just occurred. And the filmmaking then was this beautiful, I think, realism. The shooting and stuff was getting, multi-angle shooting. The storytelling was evolving and becoming really compelling. And just the ability of them to articulate life and really mirror what it was like to come home from battle and all of that stuff, I think is just getting better and better as we go with a lot of these stories, and we're really actually becoming consumed and absorbed and Yeah, the engaging nature of that medium is really shining. It's really flourishing as we've developed into what I guess we would consider the sort of modern film era.
And then the year before that, 1945, The Lost Weekend, about alcoholism. Basically a guy going through an entire weekend on a bender and how his life is being destroyed by alcohol, something a lot of people were facing back then after the war, a lot of soldiers crawling into the bottle because of bleakness and depression and trauma and
shell
things
shock.
Like that. Absolutely. So that was something, too. I'd never heard of that film either. it also inspired John Lennon to refer to his period of when he had some darkness in his life as The Lost Weekend. So there's all these cultural references that you keep finding, and it's really interesting. What we try to do is we try to see newsreels as well for the period. And what's really interesting about that, they started awarding in 1947, they started awarding foreign films as Foreign Film of the Year. And we're seeing those as well. We saw a film called Shoeshine from Italy, 1947. And kids are watching the very same newsreels that we were watching about the latest battle in World War II and things like that. But also just the way films were made in Italy, right away, completely different. There's full frontal nudity. There's curse words, all kinds of things. And in the United States, there were strict censors. You couldn't show a man and a woman in the same bed. You couldn't have an affair and get away with it. All these rules, no homosexuality at all, all kinds of things that, that people had to skirt around. So it's really, really interesting to go through these old films and see how cultures developed, how they differed, and just how they reflect on today.
Yeah, the cinematography and the beauty of the kinds of landscapes and different locations that have been chosen are all fascinating, and it's cool to contrast the differences there. And I guess, yeah, we're in the atomic age now because, well, World War II has happened, and that technology is out of the bag, and it is now the exciting post-war 50s and 60s where technology reigns, and it'll be interesting.
And there's real trepidation because of what has happened with the atomic bomb. People are saying, we've got to get it right now. We can't have another war. It's interesting to see that said in 1947, to see the fear about atomic weapons back then, to realize, wow, that was 70 years ago, and how safe are we today? So, yeah, we are definitely delving into some interesting worlds by seeing these films, and we hope to continue sharing them as we keep going year by year. We are out of time now. You can write to us, otw@2600.com. I'd like to leave you with some more dialogue from Gentlemen's Agreement about anti-Semitism, post-war United States, and we'll see you next week. Good night.
Friday night at dinner, a man told a vicious little story, and I was ill. I was sick with rage and shame. But Phil actually...
What kind of story, Jackie?
Oh, it was just a story. It had nothing to
do. Well, suppose you tell me anyway.
Well, it was just a vulgar little joke that a man told at dinner. It has nothing to do with
it. Take it easy, Jackie. Maybe it has. What kind of a joke? I could take naughty words, you know.
But why? Oh, all right. It was a man named Lockhart, and he tried to get laughs with words like... Kike and Coon, and I despised him and everybody else.
What did you do, Kathy, when he told the joke?
What do you mean?
I mean, what did you say when he finished?
I wanted to yell at him. I wanted to get up and leave. I wanted to say to everyone at that table, why do we sit here and take it when he's attacking everything that we believe in? Why don't we call him on it?
And what did you do?
I just sat there. I felt ashamed. We all just...
Yeah. And then you left and got me on the phone.
Later, after dinner was over, I said I was ill, and I am. I'm sick through.
I wonder if you'd feel so sick now, Kathy, if you had nailed him. There's a funny kind of elation about socking back. I learned that a long time ago.